Okay, I just started recording.
Thank you. So it is September 9th, 2020, 4 p.m., and I am Mayor Julia Johnson. I'm going to call the City Council to order, the meeting to order. I will begin with call of order, and second, we'll move into roll call. Councilman and Mayor Pro Tem Jared Couch.
Here.
Councilman Chuck Owen.
Here.
Councilwoman Brenda Kinzer.
Here.
Councilwoman Joellen Kesty.
Here.
Councilman Brendan McGoffin. Councilman Glenn Allen.
Here.
And Councilman Carl DeYoung.
Present.
Thank you. I'm looking for an approval of the agenda, but we have a request from Director Freiberger to pull the adoption of the 2019 sewer plan, as it needs to be in concert with the Director Coleman's comp plan. So do I have a motion?
Madam Mayor, I make a motion to approve the agenda with the exception of the sewer plan.
All right, do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. So I had a motion by Councilwoman Kinzer and seconded by Councilman Allen. Is that correct? Okay. Couch. Thank you. All right. Any more discussion or questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, moving on to the consent agenda, items 1 through 3. Do I have a motion?
Madam Mayor, I'd like a motion to approve the
consent agenda. Consent agenda, all right.
Consent agenda, right.
Okay, do I have a second?
Councilman Owen, second.
Okay. So motion by Councilman Allen, seconded by Councilman Owen. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries. So we will move right into our special guest. We have a presentation by Executive Director Becky Larson. And so Becky, I'm gonna turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mayor Johnson and the City Council of CJBOLIA. Thank you for having us today. I have a couple board members on the call and a couple staff on the call, so we really appreciate you letting us present tonight of what's been going on the food bank since COVID-19. Doug was going to have someone share the slides.
Okay. Bill, can you go ahead and put those up on the screen? They should be showing up there shortly.
So you're gonna have to go up a little bit. Perfect. So basically we wanna address some of the responses that we had for COVID-19 and increasing the food insecurity in our community and we're addressing and the increasing food. So second slide, please. So going back to actually 1973, but we were founded as a nonprofit in 1986. We were in the basement of the Catholic Church, and Helping Hands has really grown. As most of you know, this facility is our sixth location and our forever home. Thanks to the city and everybody that worked really hard to get us into this facility, we've been able to do all the things that we've done this year. In 2019, Helping Hands served over 160,000 individuals through its food bank distribution, its mobile food programs, and the Cutting Hunger on the Weekends program, which is what we used to call the backpack program. That's where we deliver food directly to children in their homes for weekends. Helping Hands prides itself on being more than a food bank. We also offer job internship programs. We've had 15 individuals go through that program, ages 16 to 24, a resource navigator center, a classroom, and Helping Hands really believes in empowering its clients with tools and resources to end the cycle of poverty. Next slide, please. If you haven't been here, we strive to be a grocery store model where people could come in 4 days a week and go shopping like a grocery store. And we really worked really hard to rescue over 3 million pounds of food that would have gone in the landfill in 2019. So as we're moving into 2020, before March, the average family walks through the building was about 750 that would actually come to the building. In the first 2 weeks of March, the number spiked to 900. That's the first time we started to see people need to be at home or their jobs, being laid off from their jobs. And really, the reality set in on the day that on a week that over 900 people walked past me directly, and we just felt like that was really unsafe. And the board called an emergency board meeting March 17th, and we decided to temporarily suspend operations until we could come up with a better, safer solution for everyone. And thank goodness for the support that we have in the community through Chief Tucker and Mayor Johnson and the Janikies. We were able to help put together a mobile food distribution really pretty quickly. So next slide. So we set up at the Food Pavilion parking lot and we started handing out food. That very first week, we served over 1,000 people in just 2 distribution days. And then next slide, please. We also supported the Anacortes food distribution site and Marble Mount. And as we progressed, we were getting calls from Concrete, Hamilton, and Alger. Pretty much they were closing due to their volunteers being over safe ages and immune compromised and not a very safe environment to be handing out food to so many people. So we took on their distributions. I remember the weekend I heard that the National Guard was coming, I was able to call those food banks and say, we will help support your organizations. During the, we expanded our CHOW program we opened it up to the whole county. We are currently doing 2,100 kids a week. We have about 300 residents that we deliver directly to their homes. We opened up a distribution site in Mount Vernon at the high school. We take care of 4 life care centers where we're delivering to over 255 employees of the life care centers. We opened a daycare center route where 150 employees from the daycare centers are getting food from the food bank. And we've helped deliver food. We work closely with the Skagit Department of Health to deliver food to those who are COVID positive. And we just seem like we're doing so many. So now Helping Hands sees an average of 6,054 families a week. So that's a big jump from 750 a week to 6,054 a week. We couldn't have done it without the National Guard. There were so many people in the community that have supported us, not only getting the National Guard, but also keeping the National Guard. I know a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails have gone out to really support that. We currently have 43 of them. We started with 8 and now we have 43. We have 5 trucks. We have their vans. We have forklift drivers. And most of them have been laid off from their jobs. They're all of them, all 43 of them are from the local area. And it's just a great partnership that we have with the Guard. And the biggest thing is that we are, I'm sorry, go to the next slide. I should catch up on the slides, I apologize. Next slide, please. So here's our National Guard. Next slide, please. So we, as we go, everybody asks us, you know, what's our plan? How are we gonna get back to the facility? And we've decided in phase one and two, we're gonna continue offsite distributions to all the sites. We're actually opening a full-time distribution, bigger model out in Anacortes starting next week or 2 weeks. We're continuing, this week, we added another like 40 chow bags, 40 more kids. We're adding mobile food more every day. So that is, we're just gonna continue as normal through phases one and two. Next slide. So phase three, we're still gonna be continuous for Cedar Woolley. We're gonna continue to do our distribution at Food Pavilion until we can get the building retrofitted for a mobile food distribution here at the facility. But as phase three goes on, we are retrofitting concrete needs, containers with electricity. We're working on Hamilton, clearing out space. We've been working with Alger, Anacortes, and Marble Mount, getting them ready so that when we're ready to move back in and they're ready to, and the National Guard steps away from doing the distribution from there, they are ready to go in a very safe and healthy way. And we will not make that decision. We'll let the food banks, you know, kind of make that decision that they're ready to go and for a safe distribution. We're going to continue our Mount Vernon pop-up distribution. All our mobile food and all our chow will continue in phase three. The picture I put on this one is the picture of two containers in front of our building. So we're working on the mobile food drive-through. We will be working out of two containers that will have electricity and heat with a carport, metal carport roof over the top for volunteers through the weather. And this will be a temporary solution, but in the long run, these will be available anytime there's a disaster for food distribution, water, because we can move them pretty quickly. We've been talking to the county about these can be mobilized to any neighborhood or community that would need food, emergency food distribution, and they'll have generators. So we're thinking past ourselves and farther into the future as having some ways to deliver food to any community that potentially needs it. So phase four. Oh, next slide, sorry. the goal is to return in phase four, but the bigger concern is what does that really look like? So what we're gonna continue to do is the mobile drive-through at the building and have a very strict volunteer protocol inside the building. And we're gonna continue to do our mobile food and chow, but we will not be at the other distribution sites. We'll just bring it all home. And the point of having the mobile drive-through is to make sure we need a vaccine and we need to make sure that everybody is safe. There's been numerous times prior to us closing and going to the distribution that we had sick people come to the door and they had no options for food, so they came anyway. So we want to make sure that we're keeping all the staff and everybody healthy, because in phase four the National Guard is gone and we want to continue to serve as many people as are needed through that time when the National Guard has left. Next slide, please. So we're working really, really closely with community partners to ensure everyone has safe access to food in each phase. It's a big deal for us to work with the county, the cities, every city, the high school in Mount Vernon. We're constantly talking with them, the life care centers, everybody, to make sure that we're supporting anybody who needs access. We're even, some of the National Guard are even starting a Meals on Wheels deliveries to make sure that, because they were low staffed and we needed to make sure that we support anybody that is needs safe access to food. Next slide, please. So our priorities are to continue to say for safe food distribution, Chow, and our mobile food program. Those are a really big, that's what we're focused on right now. Next slide. So to continue safe food distributions, we need to make sure our partner food banks and Helping Hands are retrofitted with financial assistance will be needed. To be safe for our phase four ready, additional materials and supplies will be needed to purchase to keep everyone safe. Items needed, we need plexiglass, plastic barriers, all the protocol, everything that we need to keep people clean and safe. We obviously need gravel here because it gets really muddy and wet. So we have to create a new entry point into Helping Hands, cleaning supplies, and personal protective equipment. While a final budget isn't completed yet, it'll be a pretty close to about $20,000 to $25,000 extra that we didn't budget for 2020 that we're going to need to be able to retrofit the facility. So the next slide. So I know you guys are going to be talking about we have requested to put in an access point, a gravel access point. I just wanted to kind of share some things that we've talked about. Is if you can see the black and white picture right kind of there in the bottom left corner, that big white building is a garage. It's a 1200 square foot garage. The bottom arrow shows where the old access driveway was. The top arrow shows the old barn this driveway went to. Unfortunately, this is the best picture I could find. Our goal is to fix this access driveway and add gravel for the weather and mud. The driveway will be at least two car widths, so we could have close to 60 or more cars waiting in line without even being out on Wicker Road. We'll have gates, it'll be fenced, and it will only be accessed during distribution. And we will be putting security cameras, lots of lighting, and we will obviously will be graveling it for the weather. If we come off Fruitdale, so if you look, in your packet that they sent out, page 95, there's a really good picture of what the building looks like now. And you can see where we're coming off Fruitdale. You can see the difference between how many cars you can get on this one and how many cars come off Fruitdale. It's about maybe eight before they start getting backed up on Fruitdale. And with the bus and the traffic that's on Fruitdale, we were trying, when I was walking with we were walking out how we would do this. Ex-fire chief said, you know, this is actually a better option because you would never really even back up onto Wicker Road. We will have traffic monitors on both sides to make sure the traffic is flowing. And we're also going to make more hours and more but quicker hours almost every day so that there's a nice flow and we're not plugging up the rural access roads. Next slide, please. So as of August, we're actually up to 350,000 individuals have been fed through Helping Hands since March. That is an unbelievable number when you consider 2019 was about 160,000 for the whole year. And we just see that there's a lot of data out there that shows an economic hardship till 2022 third quarter. So the food bank is not going to get, we may lose some of the clients that go to our Mount Vernon location or to Concrete and Hamilton and Alger, but we know that we're going to continue to be amazingly busy and beat records for a long time. Next slide, please. So Helping Hands' mission is to nourish our community with kindness and respect without judgment. What we're also trying to do is adjust addressing an inequity of food bank experience in Skagit County, make sure every citizen has access to high quality food and resources. And we want to make sure that any food bank that needs a help or any community that needs help, we're there to help and support them. We have an amazing group of people, donors. We have almost 760 new donors since COVID hit. We started with 1,000 since 2019, now we're like 1,700. So it has been amazing support that we felt from all over the community. That's pretty much the slideshow. Does anybody have any questions?
Okay. Doesn't sound like we do. Thank you, Becky, for the presentation, and we'll be hearing from you in just a bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say the chair recognizes Councilman McGoffin coming in to the meeting. So, good to see you, Brendan.
Thank you.
All right, so we are going to move on to staff reports, and I'll begin with Fire Chief Dean Klinger.
Good afternoon, Council, and everybody there at the food bank. Hi. I'm just giving you an update quick on COVID. Since the last Council meeting, we've had an uptick of about 58 cases. No new deaths. We're still setting it around 22 and about 93 throughout the area hospitals. We're hoping that we stay at this level fairly low so that we can start getting back to normal. We're looking for some good news coming in the future here in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So as we hear some more, we'll keep you updated.
All right, thank you.
Madam Mayor, I have a question for Chief.
Yes. Sure.
Hey Chief, could you remind us the policy of burning during the summer times and especially burning of garbage out in the fire pit?
There should be no burning of garbage. The only thing that you're allowed to burn within the city limits is a what we call a hot dog type fire, just a campfire. It has to be within an approved container, like a fire ring or some type like that. What we're seeing right now, an uptick was before the last week, where people starting to burn their limbs and so forth out in their yards. And we've been going out and educating them as to the codes and reminding them that the city does have a yard recycling center that they can take it down there to get rid of those debris. It's a lot easier and friendlier for the neighbors.
So if someone is burning garbage, that's a complaint-driven process, and
correct.
It's just a non-emergency, call 911.
Yeah, you just call 911, advise them, and the duty officer will run out there. And sometimes it's hard to locate this stuff because a lot of times you get out there, and all of a sudden they've stopped for some reason, like they knew we were coming.
All right. Thank you, Chief.
You bet.
All right. Thank you. I don't see anybody here from the police department. Is either Lieutenant McElraith or Chief Tucker online?
Mayor, this is Doug. The police department, they're working on an incident at one of the parks for a little bit, so they aren't on right now.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you for that. Director of Public Works, Mark Freiberger.
Thank you, Mayor. Not too much new to report. As you probably noticed, the work on Highway 20 on the lane widening is moving ahead. They should be paving today. I haven't made it out of the office myself, but today and tomorrow, and finishing that job up in the next couple of weeks. The Jamison overlay was completed, other than punch list work, about a week ago. So we're moving ahead. That's the last of our major projects for the year, basically. So that's about it for us, other than budget.
Okay.
Madam Mayor, I have the question for
you. I'm sorry, just a moment here.
Thank you.
Yes, in just a moment, please.
Thank you.
Mark, I have to say that I've actually received a lot of calls regarding the overlay. People are very pleased with it, and especially the sidewalks and the ADA ramps that you've put in. So, very nice. Nice work. Thank you.
You're welcome. Pass that on to the designer.
All right. Thank you. Would that be David Lee?
That's David Lee.
All right. Thank you, David Lee. Councilman DeYoung.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Hey, Mark, a couple weeks ago at our last meeting, I asked about the Dunlop and Township pylon there, a little micro roundabout. And my question is, was that designed to have large boulders within that circumference of that roundabout?
It was basically set up for plantings, which were to be maintained by one of the neighbors, which that's becoming problematic due to some moves. We had, I think, some small boulders in there originally, but it's not really designed to fill them up any more than you see in there now.
Okay, so the boulders that are there now are part of the original design, and that's what we maintain as a city?
I think so. I haven't been out there in a while. I don't know if anything has changed there.
All right. I just want to make sure we're not doing any ad hoc neighborhood improvements. Thank you, Doug. Thank you very much, Mark.
I'll take a look at it and see if anything has changed.
All right. Thank you. And Director of Building and Planning, John Coleman.
Good afternoon. Thank you. So the Planning Commission is meeting on Tuesday, 6 days from now, and they'll be working on two items. One of them is reviewing a 3-acre rezone request at the northeast portion of the golf course. This has been something that they've been working on for a little while. The property owner has requested that the area where the clubhouse is be rezoned. It's currently mixed commercial, and they want to change it to residential 5 so he could do a subdivision of the golf course. So there's a public comment period open now, so I want to get a little plug in for that so the community is aware that's going on and they have an opportunity to comment on that. The Planning Commission is also going to be reviewing possible changes to the downtown parking requirements. That's something that the council asked for earlier this year, or maybe late last year, and Planning Commission has been working on it for a while, and it's a tricky proposition. So they've been spending more than a few meetings on this one, and we still got a little work to go. So before it makes it to the City Council, and then and staff here, we're working on budget and CARES Act funding reporting, as well as lots of land use applications that have been going on. And then at the next City Council meeting, we're looking to be bringing the council a request for an annexation initiation. So this will be the first step. A property owner outside of the city limits in the urban growth area is put in a request that the City Council consider annexing their property, which will also require the annexation of other properties in between them and the and city limits. So we'll go over the details of that, but just give you a heads up there so you know what's coming at the next council meeting. And I think that's all I have to report.
And we will be joining the Planning Commission, I believe it's the 2nd of October. It's the first Wednesday in October, a joint meeting. So look forward to that. Thank you. Financial Manager Jill Scott.
Thank you, Mayor. Good afternoon, Council. Mostly right now working on just financial, closing August, getting that ready so that we can get some information to the managers for their budgets. A lot of working with different people, staff members, on the budget questions they have. And then we did get notification that we did receive some additional CARES funding, and they've also extended the deadline until, it was October 31st, and I did confirm we now have until November 30th, but we've asked the managers to basically submit what they have so far and all the CARES expenses, and I should be getting the first reimbursement request prepared here hopefully by the end of the week, if not by Monday, so we can see where we stand on that. And otherwise, I don't have a lot more to report.
All right, thank you. So the extension, has that been official, November? I I know from AWC, the information that I received from Candace Bach, she was saying that they had heard that it would be December 1st, but I don't know, in end of November, December 1st, about the same time.
Yes, I heard from the Department of Commerce, but they haven't formalized anything. So we should, what I'm understanding is we should be getting contract amendments with that extension. But it'll cut it kind of close. So I think the better, the more we can keep it closer to the end of October or mid-November, because we have a pretty quick turnaround. The federal government still requires that we that they reimburse us by December 31st. So,
okay. Good information. Okay. Thank you, Jill.
Mm-hmm.
Director of IT, Bill Chambers.
Still working on the email migration planning. The firewall wall upgrade is just about done. I should be able to deploy that by this weekend. Assisting wastewater with the planning for the WIM software upgrade and finance with the BIOS cloud transition, and working on CARES Act purchase documentation and the Council AV phase one project should be completed soon. They notified us that they got the two cameras in that they were waiting on, and that'll be great to get that up and running. That's it.
That's great news. Thank you, Bill. City Attorney Nikki Thompson.
Good afternoon, everyone. I don't actually have anything that is of interest to the group. I do a lot of behind the scenes work, and it's just not that interesting to the general public.
But the city appreciates it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And City Supervisor and Administrator, Doug Merriman.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I just have a couple of items. One, if you've been by the library lately, you'll see a lot of activity picking up as we get close to the end of the construction project. Right now, we're running at about 92 to 93% completion. And our target date is October 9th to be substantially complete with the construction. Doesn't mean we'll be open the doors yet, because the library has to move in and get everything set up and ready for the public. But we are getting close, and at this time we are running probably $200,000 to $300,000 under budget. So we're hoping we don't get any last minute surprises or anything like that. But it looks like we're going to be coming out fine financially. Some of the things you'll see happening at the library over the next 7 to 10 days, we'll be finishing up the HVAC. There'll be some of the parking lot that's the pervious parking lot. That's a special parking lot going in. And probably about 2 weeks from now, you actually start seeing the landscaping and the lights and the rest of the asphalt going in. So probably about a month from now, actually a month from today is our substantial completion date. We'll spend probably 2 to 3 weeks just doing punch list items. So we're getting close and almost ready to wrap up that project. Other things going on right now, of course, everyone is heavy into the budget and getting everything ready. We have a date of October 1st of kind of getting our first draft to just to see how things look. So that date will get up on us before we know it. So we have a lot of work to do, but everybody's working hard on that. And that's really all I have for today.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So moving on to council reports, Councilman Jared Couch.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I want to keep it brief for time, but I do want to thank Director Larson for the presentation. It's always impressive to hear what the food bank's doing. And I just want you to know that this community appreciates your leadership, your board and your volunteers, everything you guys have done through this pandemic, and you've adjusted well on the fly. So thank you very much for everything that you guys do. That's all I have.
Right. All right. Thank you. Councilman Owen.
Yes, Madam Mayor. I just wanted to share with you a few things that happened in the last couple of days. I've been out and I visited with the solid waste and I also visited today with the street department and during their lunch hour, and I came away feeling real good. The street department, as you know, they're understaffed and they work hard. And after talking to them, their attitudes and everything were so great. It really made me feel good. And I honestly think that the street department and the solid waste department is the heart of this city. They keep this city going. They keep it clean. They keep the roads up the best they can. And I had Nathan there for a little bit. And Nathan, as you know, is way overworked, but he gets the job done. And I'm proud of Nathan. So I just want you to know that it makes me proud to be part of this city, to see people like that. They're very dedicated. They have good attitudes. And I just wanted to share that with you. And I think they need to get more praise in what they do.
I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. I have to say that I also think the wastewater treatment plant falls into that part of the heart of the city, simply because what would we do if our toilets didn't flush, right? They keep that going and they keep the storm waters clear. And so we do have a good public work department for sure.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I went by the sewer plant, and when I went around the corner, I got that a little bit of an odor. So I went on down to the street department, but I will make an effort to go down. And I haven't talked to the new foreman there, but I'm going to do that too.
Kevin Nguyen, he's doing a great job. Thank you. Was there somebody else? Was somebody asking a question?
No, this is Mark. I just was going to thank Chuck for his comments and let him know that I'll pass those on. And thank you, Mayor, for noting the wastewater treatment plant. And Chuck gave the usual reason for passing them by. So.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Councilwoman Kinzer. You're muted, Brenda. You're muted. Thank you. There we go. Hello.
I'd like to echo what Jared said about the Helping Hands Food Bank. Really, really outstanding job that they've been doing, and just rolling with whatever it takes to get it done. So it's so impressive, completely. And also wanted to let everybody know that we're going to be having I think it might be the first committee meeting since COVID came, isn't it? We're going to have a Parks Committee meeting tomorrow over Zoom at 6. And it's my understanding, I believe, Bill, are you on here? Does that have to be an open public meeting?
Yes, and I'll record it. And I believe Nathan got the notices out today.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Brenda. And our new councilwoman, Joellen Kesty. Hello.
Hello. I too would like to thank the food bank for all that they do. And I'd also like to mention that the museum's reopening will be this Friday, September 11th, from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m.
Okay. Very nice. Thank you. This Friday?
Yes.
Okay, 3 to 5. All right, thank you. Councilman McGoffin.
Hi, thank you, Madam Mayor. I'd also like to echo the appreciation towards the Helping Hands Food Bank, and I'd also like to thank all the people that reached out, phone calls, emails. I did get a lot of support from multiple people, both over the phone and in person. And that really means a lot to me, hearing the community speak up in support of this. So just thank you to the Helping Hands Food Bank and everyone that called in.
All right, thank you. Councilman Glenn Allen.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I finally found the mute. I'd like to thank Bill and Glenn for getting this computer to work again. I do have something I would really request. Today is such a beautiful day. I don't know if they have the Wi-Fi capacity at Riverfront Park,
but it would be nice to have a meeting. We can social distance and we can meet our new council lady and we can meet our finance director better. And, you know, there's only one more opportunity if the weather to hold up, and then we can go back in our caves. But I don't know if it's available, but I mean, well, the park would be, but the weather, but it would be nice to have a person-to-person meeting, even 6 or 8 feet apart. And I don't know what the Wi-Fi is, but if it's good enough, I would love to have a real meeting, okay?
Sounds good. Thank you. And Councilman Carl DeYoung.
Thank you, Mayor. I think it's a bit self-serving, but I did want to thank the food bank for being here today. As the vice president of the food bank, I do want to thank all my fellow council members and the mayor for acknowledging all the hard work that the staff does out there and how our community rises to meet the need, and that it is a community effort. And it's good to see some of our board members on here. Hi, Brian. Hi, Macklin. And and eager to hear what they have to say. Just for the council to know, I will be recusing myself from that vote as an abundance of caution of a conflict of interest. Then I have, from near and dear in my heart, I would like to thank everyone that's out there fighting the fires, from the professional firefighters to the volunteer firefighters to the smoke jumpers to the wildland firefighters that have come together across this country to help deal with those forest fires. And I am putting some positive energy out every night, hoping that folks will remain safe. Besides that, Madam Mayor, that's the report from Ward 6.
All right, very nice, thank you. I just have a couple of things. You heard our finance manager, Jill Scott, talk about our CARES Act and money and the need to get the applications put in. I will say that we have received, in addition to the $350,000, which we were given a couple months ago, we received an additional $175,000, just a little over $175,000. So we're looking at about $526 that the state and the government has graciously given to us, and actually to all cities. They've all been awarded accordingly. So anyway, it was nice to have that opportunity to be able to share that with the business owners, and we'll see where this all goes from here. Meeting with the elected officials this morning, it wasn't on my radar, but they were already talking about Halloween. So I'm just going to give everybody a heads up. They are requesting that all the festivities that happen downtown and even within the town be canceled for the safety of the children and for the public. So you'll be hearing more about that. They'll be putting out a statement, and I'll be putting out a statement along with them. Other than that, we are looking to eventually open City Hall. Some guidelines have been put out. We're combing through them and looking at them to see if we are actually ready to do that. One thing that I am really wanting to be careful of is making sure that we keep our employees safe, especially after Labor Day. We'll just see where the spike goes after Labor Day, and also with the start of school to see what happens there. So just to let you know that that's something that we are looking at, not really quite sure when that'll happen, but that's what we are looking to do. All right, other than that, we will move on now to the request for the driveway improvement, Helping Hands Food Bank, and I'm gonna turn this over to our city attorney, Nikki Thompson. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Mayor. So this is an item that Doug and I have both worked on. This is a request from the food bank, which you've already heard about, to put in an additional access point to allow for a sort of a circular drive for the food bank. The reason this is coming before council is that this is pursuant to a provision in the lease agreement. And Lease agreements are within the purview of the contracting authority for the city, which is the city council. So it is city council's job to make decisions with regard to provisions in a lease that deal with real property. Bill, are you pulling up the agenda item? Or I'm sorry, I'm not sure what's going on. I'm seeing a bunch of screens flying here.
Yes, I was looking for it. I didn't see it.
Oh, no worries. So the specific lease provision here states that improvements other than the construction of a new food bank shall require prior written authorization of the city. So this evening's agenda item allows the city council to weigh in on whether or not that permission should be granted. So staff's recommendation here this evening is to have a conversation about the request from the food bank to add the additional access point that would allow vehicles to exit out Wicker Road, or whether to decline that particular request. If City Council has any specific questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I think it is appropriate to have a conversation about the pros and cons of this request and make a motion to approve or deny the request.
Okay, so do we have any comments or questions from the City Council?
Madam Mayor.
Yes, Councilman Couch.
Yes, so the only question that I had was, and Bill's got the slide up that I'm looking at too, where the pre-existing driveway was, am I correct in envisioning that that will be resurfaced with gravel to loop into what would be the west end of the pavement parking lot? So they would come off of Wicker, go through, and then exit out onto Fruitdale?
My understanding was the opposite. They would be coming in on Fruitdale and out Wicker.
Okay. So it's basically it's tying in with the asphalt parking lot that's on the north side of the building.
Correct.
Okay.
And anyone else? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and just I believe everybody's under the understanding that this is a temporary gravel road to provide some further safety precautions and better traffic flow because of the influx of people during COVID-19. Is that correct?
That is our understanding, yes.
Does anybody else have any questions?
Madam Mayor?
Yes?
Councilman Allen, I've taken my dog up over 700 times to Helmick Road to walk her every day and been by Wicker and then by the road. I think it is a perfect solution to streaming egress and ingress. And I mean, I think it's a very good plan and it would benefit everyone involved. Thank you.
Madam Mayor, is that
yes.
Councilman Coffin?
Yes, go ahead.
With Councilman Glenn, that this is a great idea and I've only heard good things about this. I mean, in support of it, and I've yet to hear a reason why we wouldn't do this. Has there been anyone that posted that or has mentioned that?
I think there has been concern. Doug, do you want to answer that? There has been concern. We did have a conversation regarding it.
Yeah, I can join in on that a little bit. There was originally some concern just about ingress and egress on the road a little bit. This isn't a city street there, and just wanted to make sure that any conversations with the county were had to make sure that that's allowable. We had some other conversations that pertained just to the lease and how the property is owned and some things like that. But those are kind of a different conversation than what we're addressing today. Right. But I think there was just wanting to make sure that the addition and the gravel and everything was a good benefit to the property. I think right. Those were the main conversations.
I know the question that I have, and it kind of goes along the line with what Doug Merriman is talking about, because the city is the property owner. And I guess what we need to know is what is the county requiring of us in order for Helping Hands Food Bank to put the gravel road in. So I didn't know if Becky had heard anything from the county yet or if they have talked to the county, but we're just wanting to know as legal owners, what is it we may need to be doing so that we're in compliance with county regulations.
So to dovetail off of that, because this is something that will likely have some effect on the underlying real property, council needs to make that determination as to whether you think it's appropriate. Yes, it's just putting gravel down, but you're creating impervious surface essentially, right? And so you are potentially creating situations where stormwater is not going to go into the ground in the same way that it would cause some runoff. It even though it is supposed to be a temporary solution, there is a likelihood that there's a longer term effect of putting in a gravel road to connect to the pavement to the north.
So is there a possibility that, I don't know, is if Becky is still on, if she could maybe answer some questions? I'm just curious, Becky, if you have been talking to the county regarding this?
I am still on. Just a couple things. We have talked to the county because it's pre-existing in maintenance. We do not need a permit. It's actually a driveway from Wicker to Fruitdale, not Fruitdale to Wicker. So they'll be coming from Wicker, turning down the road, kind of like what Jared was saying, so that we're not backing up Fruitdale. So they'll be coming from Wicker, they'll turn left, and then go through that way.
Okay. Thank you.
I guess the only other questions that I would have is, I would only, I guess, ask that it be designed. Did we do, you know, some drainage work or just, I want to see this happen, but I want to make sure that we do it correctly. You know, I don't know if Mark, if we need to look at, you know, runoff, because the last thing I want is, you know, put a gravel road in and we get a big rainstorm and somebody across the street gets an inch more water in their yard than before and they decide to sue the city. I want to find the best solution to make this road happen, but how, you know, Mark, what would we do if we were putting a road like this for an access in a city park? If we needed a service road into, I don't know, riverfront or something, what would be our purpose?
Generally speaking, the way we would handle something like this is to run it into the adjacent non-surfaced lawn area. I will say this is a county jurisdiction and it's really their call. And as far as I know, they're okay with this. There's a bit of a process to go through, which we would defer to them on for this location. But again, I think it's basically, Nikki is correct. It's something that is a possible thing, but being that it's adjacent lawn area, I just don't see a practical problem with it.
Okay.
So you don't see a problem with it? Is that correct in what you said at the end there?
I don't see a practical issue with this, no. But again, it would be the county's call. It's in their jurisdiction.
Okay. And I guess I'll just throw out one last comment just to the council where I'm at. I don't foresee an issue or have an issue with the impact of future use of the property with a, you know, reclaiming a road that was there with gravel. It would be a different conversation if, you know, the food bank comes back in a couple of years and says, well, we'd like to pave this now. And, you know, then I think we have to look at it a little bit closer, but I guess I'm I think that, you know, we need to do this because they're providing a service not only to our community, but basically the whole county. And we're helping mitigate some safety risks with traffic issues.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Any last thoughts, Nikki?
No, I think that I have adequately expressed my thoughts on this, and I would leave it up to the council.
Okay. All right, so if there are no more questions or comments, then I am looking for a motion.
Madam Mayor?
Councilman McGoffin?
I make a motion to approve the HHFB request.
Second. Mayor? Second.
Was that Councilman Allen?
Okay.
I'll motion.
Second it, right.
I have a motion by Councilman McGoffin, seconded by Councilman Allen. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, motion carries. All right. It looks like that is it because we pulled the sewer system plan off the agenda. So now we are going to finish up with our becoming credited, and that is for the Public Records Act training. It's about 30 minutes long. Bill's going to plug that in. So sit back and enjoy and I'll see you back here in 30 minutes.
Hi, I'm Bob Ferguson, your Attorney General. With me in this video is the Open Government Assistant Attorney General, Nancy Creer. This training video provides a basic overview of our Public Records Act for both records requesters and state and local agencies. It's intended to provide greater understanding of the legal requirements around the Act. The Public Records Act is a law created by an initiative vote of the people in 1972, which provides the public access to the records of government agencies. It received 72% of the vote. The purpose of the Act is to provide the public full access to information concerning the conduct of government, mindful of individuals' privacy rights, and fulfill the desire for the efficient administration of government. The law is based on the principle that open government is essential to a free society. All state and local agencies must comply with the Public Records Act. All public records must be disclosed unless a law exempts records or information. There are well over several hundred exemptions. Some of those exemptions are listed in the Act, but many exist in other state and federal laws. The Act is a broad mandate interpreted in favor of disclosure, and its exemptions are narrowly construed.
This training presentation is based on the Public Records Act and the Attorney General's Advisory Model Rules. The rules are online at the Attorney General's website at www.atg.wa.gov. They provide examples of steps to comply with the Public Records Act. An agency may adopt any part of the model rules into its own rules. Local agencies should consult the model rules when establishing local Public Records Act ordinances. The model rules provide comments that are useful for interpreting the Public Records Act and for training agency personnel. The model rules are non-binding, but they are based on extensive outreach, court decisions, and have been cited favorably in some court cases. This training video was prepared in the fall of 2017. The model rules were being updated in 2017. The legislature also amended the Public Records Act in 2017, and the legislature can amend it again in the future. The courts can also interpret the Act. Consequently, and as a reminder, there may be developments in the law after this video was prepared. Several updates on the law are often posted in materials on the Attorney General's Office website on the Open Government Training page. A PowerPoint on that page also provides training on the Public Records Act. This training video contains 16 short segments where we will review history, purpose, and intent of the Public Records Act, scope of the PRA, general obligations of an agency, what is a public record, requests for records, initial agency responses, reasonable estimates, adequate searches, disclosure, electronic records, managing broad requests, exemptions and withholding, fees, other records provisions, liability, and finally, additional resources. You have just heard from the Attorney General about the history, purpose, and intent of the Act. The Act regulates the disclosure of public records. The Act requires disclosure of public records unless a law permits withholding of a record or part of a record. The Act has many components, and compliance requires training. Training can be the difference between a satisfied requester and expensive litigation. The Act applies to both state and local agencies. A state agency includes every state office, department, division, bureau, board, and commission. A local agency includes every county, city, town, municipal corporation, special purpose district, and other forms of local government. In some cases, an entity which is not an agency can still be subject to the Act when it is the functional equivalent of an agency. This determination depends on whether it performs a government function, receives government funding, the extent of government involvement or regulation, and whether the entity was created by government. Courts are not subject to the Act.
I think he did. That was for final expenses.
Agencies must appoint a public records officer responsible for being a point of contact for the public and for overseeing compliance. The name and contact information of the public records officer should be published with information on how to submit requests for records. The public records officer must have received training under the Act within 90 days of assuming his or her duties. Agencies must also publish information on the agency organization, rules and procedures, and an index of specific categories of records. Agencies are required to adopt reasonable rules to provide full public access to public records, to protect public records from damage or disorganization, to prevent excessive interference with other essential functions of the agency, and to provide the fullest assistance to inquirers. Agencies may wish to consult with their attorneys when developing their rules and procedures. A public record is any writing relating to the conduct of government which is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. It could be an email, text message, paper, letter, or memo, an audio or video recording, a picture, image, map, or any recording of information or data compilation from which information may be obtained or translated. A public record is not just what an agency creates, but includes documents created by citizens or private companies that are used or received by a government for a governmental purpose. A public record may also include documents not possessed by the agency, but which were used by the agency. For example, the courts have described that work documents on the personal computer, personal cell phone, or personal email account of an agency employee or official are subject to a request under the Public Records Act. Records of certain volunteers are excluded from the definition of public record. Records are excluded when they are not otherwise required to be retained and are held by volunteers who do not serve in an administrative capacity, have not been appointed by the agency to an agency board, commission, or internship, and do not have a supervisory role or delegated agency authority. Any person wishing to inspect or copy public records of an agency should submit the request to the agency, preferably in writing, using the agency's request form. The Public Records Act doesn't prescribe any official format for a valid request, so an agency must honor valid requests for identifiable records regardless of the format of the request. While using an agency's form is not required, it is typically the most efficient way to submit a request. A requester who chooses not to use an agency form must give the agency fair notice that he or she is submitting a request for public records. Agencies are required to honor requests received in person during an agency's normal office hours or by email. If an agency has adopted reasonable rules on how requests should be submitted, the agency may rely on those rules. The agency should be helpful to the requester in explaining how a request should be submitted and to whom. Records shall be available for inspection and copying upon request for identifiable records. So requesters should give a reasonable description of the records, enabling the agency to search for potentially responsive records. A request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a proper request for identifiable records. A request regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name shall not be considered a request for all of an agency's records. A request for information is not the same as a request for public records. The Public Records Act does not apply to requests for information. There is no duty to create a record that does not exist in order to fulfill a request for records or information. However, requests for information are at times easier to fulfill. Fulfilling a request for information may avert a large public records request. An agency must promptly respond to public records requests. Within 5 business days of receiving a request, an agency must respond. An initial response may be any one of the following: acknowledging receipt of the request and providing a reasonable estimate to respond, or fulfilling the request, or providing an internet address and link to the records on the agency's website, or seeking clarification while also, to the greatest extent possible, providing an estimate of time for further response if the request is not clarified, or denying the request with an accompanying written statement of the specific reasons. Reasonably clear requests for identifiable records may require no clarification. However, some requests are unclear. Seeking clarification permits the agency to identify responsive records, which in turn will aid in determining the scope of the request. Clarifying a request provides the fullest assistance to the requester so that the requester receives and pays for only those copies that are desired. Clarification may also result in prompt disclosure by identifying only those records desired. An agency should not seek clarification if the request is for identifiable records and is reasonably clear. If the entire response is unclear and the requester fails to respond to the agency's request for clarification, the agency need not respond to it. However, the agency must respond to those portions of a request that are clear. An agency may deny a bot request, which is a request that was automatically generated by a computer program or script when it is one of multiple requests from the requester received within a 24-hour period. The agency must establish that responding to the bot request would cause excessive interference with other essential agency functions. A requester is typically not required to provide a reason for a request unless a law necessitates additional information from the requester. Agencies and requesters are encouraged to promptly communicate with each other if there are issues regarding a request. An agency's initial response to a public records request must provide a reasonable estimate for the time to respond when more time is needed. A reasonable estimate should account for many factors, including the time to have the requester clarify the request if needed, as well as time to assemble and review the records, provide notice to affected persons or agencies if needed, to redact exempt information, and to create a withholding or exemption log. An agency should not use the same estimate for every request. Rather, each reasonable estimate should be based on factors such as the complexity of the request, other pending requests, agency resources, and other agency essential functions. It's a good practice for an agency to briefly explain to the requester the basis for the estimate in the initial response. Extending the estimate is appropriate when circumstances have changed or additional information has come to light. Agencies are encouraged to briefly explain the need to revise an estimate. An agency bears the burden of showing that its search was adequate. Consequently, agencies should be able to document how a search was conducted and, for example, what search terms it used, as well as the location searched. An adequate search depends on the facts of each request, but it is one that is reasonably calculated to uncover all responsive documents in whatever form, paper or electronic. The agency must make more than a perfunctory search and follow obvious leads as they are uncovered. The search should not be limited to one or more locations if there are additional places where responsive records are likely to be found. If responsive public records are likely to be found on or in an agency employee's or official's personal device or account, the employee... employee or official must search those devices and accounts for responsive records. It is possible to conduct an adequate search and still not locate a responsive document. However, if a responsive record is not located and/or if challenged in court, the agency will have to prove its search was adequate. An agency must make records available during its customary office hours for a minimum of 30 hours per week. Public records are presumed to be open for inspection and copying unless a specific law exempts the record or information from disclosure. Agencies can deliver copies of records to a requester in a number of ways, such as providing links to the records that are on the agency's website, providing paper copies of paper records or scanned copies of paper records by mail or making them available for pickup, or providing electronic records by various methods. You may recall that with respect to what is a public record, the Public Records Act does not distinguish between paper and electronic records. Most agencies create records in an electronic format. A copy of an electronic record should be produced in the requested electronic format if reasonably feasible. Translating a record into an alternative electronic format at the request of the requester, or scanning a paper record, is not creating a new record. Metadata is information embedded in a document that provides detail about the document's characteristics. This may include information such as when the document was created, edited, recipients, and so forth. Non-exempt metadata must be disclosed when expressly requested. When agencies obtain new technologies, they should consider not only the agency's business operation needs, but also records retention and disclosure requirements. Examples of such technologies are portals through which records can be requested and delivered, electronic redaction tools, or retention software, just to name a few. In addition, agencies can look at whether they could make use of their current technology more robust. The legislature encourages agencies to make public records widely available electronically, particularly commonly requested records. For example, an agency could make commonly requested records available on its website. Then, as noted earlier, an agency could fulfill its obligation to provide access to a public record by providing a requester with a link to a specific agency webpage containing the electronic copy of the requested record. For requesters without access to the internet, an agency could provide a computer terminal at its office. Agencies should develop policies addressing technology concerns, such as if and when agency employees may use personal devices for public agency uses, and what responsibilities and requirements therefore attach to the employee. An agency may receive a broad request that asks for any and all records related to a topic. Agencies may not deny a request solely because it is overly broad. As noted, a request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a valid request. But a request for all records regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name is not a request for all of an agency's records. After an initial search shows there are potentially hundreds or thousands of different types of responsive or potentially responsive records, a public records officer should contact the requester to explain the estimated total number of records that would need to be searched, or provide other information describing the anticipated scope of the search. Then the agency could seek clarification to ask if the requester wants all of the different types of responsive records and is willing to pay for all the copies, or instead if the requester is seeking only some of the records. Good communication can assist both the agency and the requester. A broad request will usually result in a longer estimate of time for disclosure, as well as producing records in batches or installments. When seeking clarification, to the greatest extent possible, the agency must provide a reasonable estimate of time the agency will require to respond to the request if it is not clarified. In many instances, a requester will narrow the scope of the request to enable the agency to provide disclosure more promptly and less expensively. An agency may manage broad requests in a couple ways. An agency may require a deposit in an amount not to exceed 10% of the estimated cost of providing copies for a request. If an agency makes copies in response to a request available on a partial or installment basis, the agency may charge for each part of the request as it is provided. If an installment of a records request is not claimed or reviewed, the agency is not obligated to fulfill the balance of the request. Finally, use of electronic technologies to search, review, redact, and disclose public records can reduce overall costs of compliance for agencies. Agency responses denying in whole or in part inspection or copy of any public record shall include a statement of the specific exemption authorizing the withholding of the record and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Exemptions exist throughout the Public Records Act and other state and federal laws. Common exemptions include information such as personal information in files maintained for agency employees, if private, pending investigative files compiled by law enforcement or agencies with authority to discipline members of a profession, the non-disclosure of which is essential to effective law enforcement or for the protection of any person's right to privacy, educational records of students in public schools, attorney-client privilege information or work product related to litigation, or protected healthcare information. There is no statute providing a general privacy exemption. If privacy is an express element of a specific exemption, it is only invaded if disclosure would be both highly offensive to the reasonable person and also not of legitimate concern to the public. Exemptions in the Act must be construed narrowly. The general rule is that an agency redacts or withholds only the exempt information and produces the non-exempt information. An acceptable way of providing this information to the requester is with a withholding index, often called an exemption log. The information provided as part of the log should include a description of the type of record or part of record denied. The description should include identifying information from the document. For example, whether the document is a letter or email, the date the document was created or other relevant date, the total number of pages, and the sender and recipients. The exemption log must also include the statutory authority making the information exempt and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Some of this information will be evident on the face of the document where redactions have been made to only part of the document. An exemption log, the written explanation, also may be provided in different formats. For example, may be handwritten or compiled in a spreadsheet or chart, or in a letter, or redactions are marked on the records with exemption codes, and the requester is given the key to the codes. The format of the exemption log or exemptions is not relevant so long as the required information is provided. Any person may inspect non-exempt public records for free. An agency may not charge for the time of staff to search, review, or redact public records when preparing them for inspection. If a requester wants copies of records, an agency has options to charge for copies. It can charge actual costs, or it can charge default fees listed in the Public Records Act, or it can charge an alternative up to $2 fee for an entire request. Some other provisions may be relevant too. In order to charge actual costs, an agency must make available for public inspection and copying a statement of the actual per page or other costs and how it determined actual costs. An agency may adopt its statement of actual costs only after providing notice and a public hearing. When calculating fees, the agency must use the most reasonable, cost-efficient method available to the agency. Staff time to copy and deliver the requested public records may be included in an agency's costs, but an agency may not include staff salaries, benefits, or other general administrative or overhead charges unless those costs are directly related to the actual cost of copying the public records. An example of when an agency may want to charge for the actual costs of staff time is where an agency scans paper records and copies them into an electronic format. The charges should be reasonable and related to the wage of the person likely to be repeatedly assigned to this task. If an agency does not have staff available to make copies, for non-exempt records, an agency may send a scanning or copying project to an outside vendor and pass on the actual cost to the requester. Electronic copy costs may include the actual cost of the electronic production or file transfer of the record, the use of any cloud-based data storage processing service, and the cost of transmitting electronic records, including the use of a physical media device. A second method to charge copy costs is for an agency to choose to use a statutory default fee schedule provided in the Act. In that case, an agency need not calculate actual costs if it has rules or regulations declaring the reasons doing so would be unduly burdensome. The statutory default fee schedule lists, for example, per page costs for paper records, scan records, and costs for electronic records. As yet another alternative, an agency can assess an up to $2 flat fee for an entire request when certain conditions are met. The Act includes other fee provisions. For example, an agency cannot charge for access to or downloading of records it routinely posts on its website prior to the receipt of a request, unless the requester has specifically asked that the agency provide records through other means. An agency may impose the actual cost of a customized service charge when the request would require the use of IT expertise to prepare data compilations, or when such customized access services are not used by the agency for other business purposes. The agency must notify the requester and take other steps if it chooses to do a customized service. An agency can require an advance 10% deposit before making copies. An agency may enter into a contract, memorandum of understanding, or other agreement with a requester for an alternative fee arrangement, or in response to an extensive or frequently occurring request. An agency may choose to waive any charge pursuant to agency rules and regulations. Upon request, an agency must provide a summary of the applicable charges before making copies. The requester then may choose to revise the request to reduce the number of copies and the cost. In sum, the Public Records Act provides an agency several options for assessing charges for copies. The choices selected may vary from agency to agency. Under a different law, the records retention laws at RCW 40.14, agencies must maintain a log of public records requests, including for each request, the identity of the requester if provided, date of receipt, text of request, description of records produced, description of records redacted or withheld and the reasons for doing so, and the date of final disposition. With respect to the identity of the requester, it is possible an agency received only an email address from the requester, and if so, that address would be included in the log. The logs must be retained per the agency's records retention schedule and are a public record. The records retention law also provides that agencies spending at least $100,000 to fulfill requests during the prior fiscal year must report 17 data points about their PRA requests to the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee. Under the Public Records Act, any person having been denied an opportunity to inspect or copy a public record may seek further review in the agency. The person may also file a lawsuit to enforce his or her right to access public records. A requester can also file a lawsuit if he or she believes that an agency has not made a reasonable estimate of the time or of the charges to provide public records. Such a lawsuit is to be filed in a court within 1 year of an agency's final definitive response to a request, such as a final claim of exemption or the last production of public records on an installment basis. The agency has the burden of proof to demonstrate that public records were lawfully denied or its estimates were reasonable. If it does not make this showing, an agency will pay the requester's reasonable attorney's fees and costs and may pay potential penalties for denying records in violation of the Public Records Act. A court will consider mitigating and aggravating factors in determining a penalty amount. Lawsuits for public records can be extremely time-consuming and expensive for agencies. Understanding and correctly applying the law is a good risk management tool for state and local government. In rare cases, individual employees may also be civilly or criminally liable under other laws. State agency employees and state officers are subject to the Ethics in Public Service Act. It is a violation of that state ethics law for a state employee or officer to intentionally conceal a public record required to be released under the Public Records Act. State agency employees and officers may be fined up to $5,000 per violation of the state ethics law. It's also a crime for any agency officer to willfully mutilate, destroy, conceal, erase, obliterate, or falsify any record of that agency's office, except where the law expressly authorizes the non-disclosure or destruction of records. The crime is punishable by imprisonment of up to 10 years or a fine of up to $5,000 or both.
Thank you for participating in the Attorney General's Open Government Training. For more information, there are available resources for agencies to receive training and technical assistance for compliance with the Public Records Act. An employee should first consult with its agency's public records officer for routine assistance or training. Additional resources are listed on this website. The Assistant Attorney General for Open Government is also available to provide information about the Public Records Act. Thanks again for watching.
Okay, that is it. We've met a requirement. Good news. We'll fill out the certificate so that everybody, it shows that everybody has completed all the requirements met by the state. And unless there's anything for the good of the order, we are adjourned. Have a good night, everybody.